Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday. It's the 20th of July, June, not July yet. No, that's coming up. June, and we couldn't be more happy to have you all here. I had a holiday yesterday. It was Juneteenth. And then here we are today. And then tomorrow we'll have a weekend. So. Sounds like a plan.
And summer weather.
That's
at long last.
Right, at long last. Today is gorgeous. I know it's going to get hot and oppressive, but right now it's just like beautiful, beautiful weather. Good morning, all. Let me introduce our fantastic group to you. We'll get started. We have a lot to discuss. We welcome your questions, as always. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Just a very quick shout out to our dear friends Chris and Mary Jo Gibson. We had an amazing event, a WAMC on the road event at Kinderhook Books on Wednesday evening. And we were talking to Chris about his new book, Spirit of Philadelphia. And Mary Jo Gibson, his wife, put on just an amazing, lovely, lovely reception for everyone. And we had just incredible listeners and some new folks. And we Kinderhook is lovely. I went to the Martin Van Buren house beforehand, which is fascinating. Yep. It was just so interesting. And so I just wanted to thank all of them and thank the folks at Kinderhook Bookstore who just laid out the red carpet and just were so nice to us and to all of the people who were there and so friendly and lovely and we stood in the rain for a really long time and talked to each other, and it was very nice. We didn't even try to get out of the rain. We were just enjoying it. So my thanks to them, and we'll broadcast that interview soon with Chris Gibson about his new book, Spirit of Philadelphia. So again, our thanks to them. All right, let's move on and thank remind you to go panel at WAMC.org. And now let me introduce our group to you. We welcome Sienna Freeman Tolbert, partner with the Albany Law Firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
I am very happy to be here.
Well, excellent. That is evading the question, but I thank you very much. Alexander Milovic is here. Alexander, good morning. How are you?
Doing very well.
Mic 3 for Alexander, I believe. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can now.
Yeah, doing very well. Better that the microphone is on.
Yes. So. Well, it's always good when we can hear you. But you, Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of Illiberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, and a great pleasure to have Alexander Mihailovic with us this morning. Thank you very much. Robert Pendicio is with us as well, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Robert, good morning.
Good
How
morning,
are you?
Joe. I am well, and I'm actually really looking forward to the miserably hot summer weather. Where I live about 20 miles south of here in the hill towns, Rensselaerville, Medusa, it has been March for about 3 months now. So bring it.
No, that's true. Absolutely true. I don't think it has to be 30 and then 90, however. I do think there could be some sort of intermediate.
But on average, we're having a great spring.
No, it's just fantastic. Well, thank you all, everyone, and let's get started with the stories of the day. There are many to discuss. But we're basically going to pick up where we left off on Wednesday. And that is the options for the United States regarding Iran. And what really has changed now from Wednesday was in regards to the president, will he, won't he, of what the position was going to be. Now the president appears to have bought himself some time and is opening up some new options by doing that. The president appears to be offering one more off-ramp to the Iranians, and he is also bolstering his own military options. The sudden announcement that he could take up to 2 weeks to decide whether to plunge the United States into the heart of the Israel-Iran conflict is being advertised by the White House as giving diplomacy one more chance to work. But it also opens a host of new military and covert options. Assuming he makes full use of it, Mr. Trump will now have time to determine whether 6 days of relentless bombing and killing by Israeli forces, which has taken out one of Iran's two biggest uranium enrichment centers, much of its missile fleet, and its most senior officers and nuclear scientists, has changed minds in Tehran. The deal that was rejected earlier this month by the Ayatollah would have cut off Iran's main pathway to a bomb by eventually ending enrichment on uranium soil. May look very different now than one of its largest nuclear centers has been badly damaged, and the president is openly considering dropping the world's largest conventional weapon on the second, or it may simply harden the Iranians' resolve not to give in. I will, just because at heart I am a cynical journalist, so I will say that at heart there is a great article in the New York Times today as well about this 2 week time frame that the president, over his time in office as both the 45th and 47th president, has used time and time again, that it's just sort of it's a bookmark, it's a placeholder, and it can be 2 weeks, it could be 2 days, it could be never, and but it is a time frame. And I say that not so much as a criticism, but I think just as an understanding that this has a lot of wiggle room in it, that I don't think we're going to see, you know, we're not going to be watching the clock and say, oh, you know, we have 11 hours left until the 2 weeks is up to make a decision. So that is where we are at this very moment. Alexander, let's begin with you.
Well, one of the things that strikes me about this moment is the way in which this shows up some of the fissures within the Republican Party. And also, by extension, I think, Netanyahu's ruling coalition. Because one of the things that I think is important to bear in mind is that already in May, Trump nixed the idea of an attack on the Iranian nuclear facilities. This was something that Netanyahu wanted him to do. But he very emphatically said to Netanyahu, no, this is a very poor idea. So in some sense, what's happened is that this supposed coalition between Netanyahu and Trump is a little bit more precarious than we might think. This also points to something else within Israeli politics, which is that there is widespread dissatisfaction among the Israeli public with Netanyahu's policies. And in fact, 70% of the population would like to see him no longer be president in the next election. Right. I just want to add a little bit more to this, before passing it on to other people here. The other aspect of this is the fissures within the Republican Party. Normally, the defense of Israel, its right to exist, has been a kind of a hardcore Republican position. However, right now we're seeing some tension among certain people in the party who are very important, such as J.D. Vance, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and also some of the libertarians, such as Laurent Paul, who do not want to see an American military involvement, and who also, are trying to appeal, I have to cut to the chase here, to the anti-Semitic wing of the MAGA movement, which sees Israel as constantly being a vector for the United States' historical nation-building policies. So there's this kind of split between the nativist isolationist wing and with the so-called pro-Israel wing of the Republican Party, which has become more pronounced just within the last couple of days. Where it will go, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see.
Sienna.
I mean, we're watching that riff right now. We all saw it on. We all know. Everyone knows there's 92 million, and the population in Iran is 92 million based on that Tucker Carlson interview. So, I mean, that's been going, you know, viral. Watching what's happening within the Republican Party, but on it from an immigration perspective, I just think about what will happen if we move forward with this and bomb Iran. What happens then? And I can't help but think about what happened in Afghanistan and what happened. What were the implications there? As we speak right now, after that, 20-year so skirmish war, what have you, in Afghanistan, now they're on our ban list for immigration, and they're no longer allowed to come into the U.S. except for a few exceptions. So I just kind of worry about whether there will be any kind of, I've heard the phrase used and I like it, positive political transformation if this happens. What are the long-term implications of this if this happens? And that's what I think about, you know, on a long-term basis after we've seen what's happened with in Afghanistan and with the Afghans and what's happened here in the U.S. and reflection. And because of that, I just keep thinking about what happens if we bomb this nation long-term. Will there be political transformation or not?
Yeah. I'll jump in and say that the politics of this are a second-order concern for me, at the very least. I'm probably more hawkish on this than just about any foreign policy thing that I can think of. It is absolutely in America's best interest to never live to see a day, any of us live to see a day with a nuclear-armed Iran. That this is not a new point for me. This has been, you know, a hardcore belief of mine for a very, very long time. Alex, you were talking about the Republican coalition. That's kind of fascinating to me as well. You're hearing, and look, I'll be blunt. I don't take people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Tucker Carlson very seriously at all. That said, you know, I think there's been a lot of overwrought commentary about how, oh, this is fracturing the MAGA coalition, et cetera. You know, we can't, you know, Trump promised not to get us into forever wars. This doesn't feel like a forever war to me. This feels to me like a strategic strike. In other words, and by the way, Joe, within 2 weeks, this could look incredibly differently. I mean, within 2 weeks, you might be able to dismantle the Iranian nuclear program with a socket wrench and a pair of pliers at the rate this is going.
Well, and the president made that very clear, I think, on prior to saying 2 weeks, when he spoke on Wednesday and said, we're a long way from where we were one week ago.
Exactly.
And so it's a fair point of where we're going to be in 2 weeks.
Yeah, but the idea, you know, you're hearing the Powell doctrine invoked, you know, you break it, you buy it. I don't see any strategic interest here, frankly, and I don't hear any rhetoric coming out of Trump or others about regime change. This is not about regime change. This is about stopping the Iranian nuclear program, period, full stop.
But are you saying that you think we've learned the lessons of Iraq, we've learned the lessons of Afghanistan, so there won't be any of these long-term implications
in the past? No, sorry to interrupt. I'm merely saying that this is a different set of facts on the ground than in those conflicts. Iraq was a, correct me if I'm wrong, it was a deliberate attempt at regime change. This is not that. This is about creating a safer world.
Yeah, I take your point about that this is not about regime change. I mean, there are some of the statements that the Trump administration has issued would seem, you know, kind of, you know, tip the hat in that direction a little bit, but it's very perfunctory. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly not their main agenda. The main agenda is international security, so it seems, for the Trump administration. And giving credit where credit is due, they're trying to force the issue of a long festering wound in international security issues vis-a-vis Iran. Right? It is a profoundly, deeply anti-Semitic country. You know, in terms of its policy.
No question.
I'm not talking about the population. I'm speaking about, you know, the official foreign policy of the country. So there's that to bear in mind. And, you know, some people such as Elliot Cohen, you know, who had served in, you know, as security advisors for various Democratic administrations have said, look, you know, we have to admit that, you know, this is a form of legitimate statesmanship that Trump is engaging in, albeit it's in his own very belligerent theatrical version, you know.
You think?
So now there are a couple of other things that what complicates this is also, and this is probably a discussion that's going to bleed into our conversation about, you know, Russian and Israeli policy towards Iran is that Iran is a conventional weapons powerhouse in terms of its technology. It really wants, so like the last step in its security, you know, profile is to have access to nuclear weapons. And what Trump has been suggesting is that he would draw perhaps the largest conventional weapon on the nuclear facilities. He's now kind of flipped over, you know, late May. He's saying, well, maybe we will do this, maybe we won't. Siena, I'm not absolutely sure, but it seems that this seems to be a part of his two-week horizon that he's talking about, that Joe, you talked about, that, mm-hmm. you know, the so-called...
15 seconds.
Anyway, the 15-ton, penetrating bombs that he's suggesting or proposing we would drop on, you know, those facilities.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on this topic. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. The music was Sly and the Family Stone this morning, and we lost both Brian Wilson and Sly Stone last week, and we were in fun drive, so we could not have our usual memorial on the radio, so we do that this morning as we finish out this week. You can see all of the music that we play this morning and all the time at WAMC.org/roundtable, WAMC.org/roundtable, to check out the panel bumper music. All right. Alexander was making a point just before we went to a break. Anybody want to add on to that?
I actually have a question for Alex.
Go.
Because I don't pretend to be a expert in Israeli politics whatsoever. But here's an idea I just want to run by you.
Yeah.
Isn't it good for the region and good for America if the two-week window expires and Israel accomplishes its ends alone? In other words, is it not good for the region? Is it not good for geopolitically if Israel is no longer seen as a client state of the U.S.? If they emerge as they're already a power, but a more formidable power acting without U.S. assistance in the region. That's good for world stability, right?
Well, it's an excellent question. It would be good for world stability. However, Netanyahu specifically asked the U.S. Defense Department to provide weapons that Israel itself does not have.
Right.
And so they want, very specifically, this 15-ton GBU -57 penetrating bomb.
The so-called MOAB, the
mother of all bombs, which Trump has this kind of grim fascination with. He's talked about it during his first administration. And so I guess my point is that, you know, we cannot assume that all political actors in Israel are necessarily interested in the kind of autonomy that you're speaking of.
Mm-hmm.
Although there are other parties within Israel who are. But, you know, the ruling coalition at the moment does not endorse that. And the ruling coalition's favorability ratings in Israel are 48%, which is not very good. So, yeah.
And so I think all of these indicate to me that everyone is leaning in, everyone in that area, if they're not, he doesn't have a high approval rate for what he's doing. It indicates to me that we're in that situation that I'm speaking about, which is that everyone's concerned about what happens afterwards.
Right.
What happens? I think everyone agrees that, you know, Iran should not have nuclear weapons. I think everyone agrees that, but I think everyone worries about what happens in that vacuum. What happens afterwards? What does that look like? And I think that's the hesitation for a lot of people. Yeah.
For me, again, it's a legitimate concern. There's always, you know, unintended consequences of every policy lever that you pull. But it's at present, for me at least, it's a second order concern.
Well, I think that one, you know, thing that can happen is that, you know, Trump essentially wants to see some kind of collapse of the political establishment in Iran.
Sure.
But then what happens afterwards? Are we going to get some kind of MAGA style, you know, modern dictator? I mean, a dictator in Iran who sort of pushes, you know, further modernity and some reforms as a kind of a sop, you know, to people who are concerned about the political future, you know, of Iran. And then all of this in order to make deals with a new Iran that's more pragmatic. I mean, there are all sorts of, I think that the major destabilizing factor is Trump's transactionalism. On one level, he's very pro-Israel, or so he says he is. On the other hand, there's this split between him and Netanyahu as far as Iran is concerned. And how is that going to play out in the long term?
Alex, surely the most destabilizing force are the mullahs.
Sure, they're a major destabilizing force, but I don't know. I mean, he's not taking a clear-cut position about what he wants to accomplish in Iran. That's what concerns me. I think bottom line, you know, I think all of us here agree that it's not, you know, nobody wants Iran to have full nuclear capabilities.
Yeah.
We all agree in that. But the problem is, you know, what form is that new government going to take? And, you know, we'll see.
I don't know. I think we're getting ahead of ourselves here.
Perhaps.
I mean,
yeah,
and it's not my job to defend this or any elected official, the president or any elected official.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's unusual, by Trump standards, clarity on the goal here. And it's Iran must not have a nuclear weapon, period, full stop.
Yeah. I think.
But I feel like that I'm getting that message from the White House. You're not hearing it.
I am hearing it.
Okay.
I am hearing it. But there's goals are one thing, means are another.
Sure.
I'll bite. It does seem muddled, though. It does seem like there was a back and forth, and I will.
It's still Donald Trump, for Pete's sake.
Well, I know, but that. Well, right. That's the point, though, right? I mean, it's from the White House. I do think that it is. I understand what you're saying, but I also don't think it's always very clear because there's, you know, the statements like, well, I'll make my decision 1 second before I tell you,
yeah,
and that kind of thing, that makes it much more difficult to fully realize what is on and off the table.
I used to be a fifth grade teacher, and one of the things that to this day my fifth grade students, you know, now well into their 30s, I'm sure will say that Mr. P used to say all the time was, you know, not every thought that comes into your head needs to come out of your mouth. Donald Trump was not one of my fifth graders. Let's just leave it at that.
Well, that's encouraging. Okay, so
the world would be different if he had been.
Yeah, he's not known for his rhetorical restraint, right? But look, can I make one more serious
point?
Which is, look, I think there may be some strategic value. I'm contradicting myself. Maybe he actually did think through that 2-week window, because as we said before, things could look very, very different in 2 weeks. And then Trump being Trump, he'll take credit for, well, this is, you know, I gave them 2 weeks and now our work here is done.
Alexander, where do you think all of this, I mean, we've touched on this, of course, but for the rest of the world, I mean, we think of what happened to the G7, and I'm just curious as to our allies and the rest of the world as they look at this, and I do want to bring you in on even Russia's standing on this as well, given your expertise in that area of, okay, so there's what we're going to do, and then there's what the rest of the world is thinking.
Well, I think that the rest of the world is very concerned about, you know, the economic picture being affected by these major conflicts, you know. And This came through very interestingly in the recent World Economic Forum that took place in St. Petersburg. This was before Israel's bombing of the Iranian nuclear facilities. This is an event that Putin has been hosting for quite a while. Putin, St. Petersburg is his hometown. Historically, in the late Soviet period up to the present day, St. Petersburg has had all these kinds of very, organic links to global commerce by virtue of its location. And one of the things that he emphasized in his statement at that event was the necessity for bringing prices down and stabilizing the global economic picture. In other words, that there should be as few military conflicts and conflagrations as possible. And he connected this all to the standard of living of people, of citizens of the Russian Federation, that inflation is out of control. At that time, the oil prices were, slumping, which is not good for the Russian Federation. Ironically, since the bombing of the nuclear facility in Iran, oil prices have spiked, which is good for Russia because it's one of the major sources of oil outside of the Middle East. So this is good for their economy in the short run. I think that just a short answer to this is that there is a sense, I think the G7, even, in addition to people, like Trump and like Putin, who are interested in, forming a kind of a sort of, a band of brothers,
right.
Nationalist politicians, there is a sense that, economics really trumps everything, And so, we need to create a situation where, we can form new allyships. For Russia, that's primarily with the United States, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. The same with the United States, which is why Netanyahu apparently has felt snubbed by the United States because of its enhanced relations with some of the Arab states.
Anybody else on that?
Well, I'm going to ask Alex another question. Sorry, Joe, I'm taking over your job today. What do you make of Putin's? I don't want to say he's throwing his Iran under the bus, but Iran is not getting Russian backing, perhaps the way they were assuming they would.
Right. So one thing, you will never hear from me a defense of Vladimir Putin. Having said that, he has always been. And the Russian Federation in general, since its establishment in 1991, has always been against the idea of a nuclear Iran.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. So, I was not aware of that.
Right. Yeah. They've always been against that. Having said that, however, their exchange of technology in regard to conventional weapons with Iran is huge. Russia gives some to Iran.
Okay.
All right. Iran has better drone capabilities and tech than the Russian Federation has. Right now, Ukraine has superior drone technology and weaponry to the Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So essentially, Russia went to Iran for them to assist in the war with Ukraine. They're kind of, on the one hand, Putin is very happy that this has happened, this bombing has happened, because it kind of underscores Russia's position vis-a-vis nuclear capabilities of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
It also distracts from the war, the invasion of Ukraine, right? Which Russia is very very interested that there will not be any, hearings in the international court, about human rights violations, in Ukraine, of which there are many, many. So it's treading a very fine line. It's being friendly with Iran in terms of certain industries, but not in terms of nuclear weaponry.
Okay.
But one last thing I just want to add to this, which is important, is that the two nuclear power plants in Iran were designed and built by Russian tech.
Okay.
Right. The Russian Federation excels in the construction design of nuclear power. All right. Over a quarter of its energy is generated by nuclear power plants.
Okay.
which is much more than the United States. I can't remember what the exact the American figure is, but it's very small.
Sure.
It's in the single
but
digits.
We were speaking earlier about the unintended consequences of military action, and I'm not backing off my position that those are second-order concerns, but could this be a good second-order unintended consequence? In other words, anything that drives a wedge between Russia and Iran is also good for the U.S.,
it's
right?
It's good. I'm not sure how powerful a wedge that is going to actually be, given you know Russia's involvement in other aspects of their sort of, you know, their infrastructure, you mm-hmm. know. Russia, you know, can stand, you know, firm about, no, you will not get nuclear technology, while also helping them with other things. These are not, sadly, mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
So,
let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go to listener letters. We'll continue our conversation. We welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this.
Sorry.
All right, let's cue up the mailbag for this Friday morning and find out what's on your mind as we discuss what is going on specifically with the United States and a decision on Iran. Let's begin with Mickey, who says, correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't the Iraqi insurgents funded by Iran? I bring this up as an example of the nuance between the two conflicts and who we were fighting before we left Iraq. Anyone on that?
That's true. They were, but I think, you know, it was segments of the Iraqi insurgents. It wasn't this kind of, the insurgency was not made possible by, you know, Iranian support. I mean, it was one important element, but I think that, you know, we need to, yeah, but that's a good point to raise.
Here's an oldie but a goodie. If Obama's deal with Iran had stayed in place, what would the situation be now?
We would be days away from a nuclear-armed Iran. That's what the situation would be. That was a terrible deal. I'm sorry, folks. That was a terrible, terrible deal. And good for Trump for scuttling it during his first term.
Other thoughts?
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Listen.
Well, can I just add, the reason that was a terrible deal was because it didn't preclude a nuclear-armed Iran. It just basically stopped the clock for 10 years.
I mean, you're never going to get me to agree that, you know, I don't agree, but we'll leave it at that.
All right. I mean, I wonder, I mean, one could argue certainly that whatever damage, significant damage that Trump and Netanyahu might do to the nuclear capabilities of Iran right now, that is a kind of a hardware version of stopping the clock.
Say more, a hardware version?
Well, you know, it's not policy driven. It's not dependent on, you know, inspections and other things like this that, you know, what I've read so far, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next several days, is that the damage is critical but not catastrophic to its, you know, nuclear enrichment.
I'm sorry, I was confused. I thought you were talking about the JCPOA, the so-called Iran nuclear deal from 10 years ago. You're talking about the kinetic action that's happening right now.
Right, yeah, but
okay.
I'm comparing them also.
Okay.
You know, I'm comparing them in the sense that, you know, in terms of evaluating them for their overall effectiveness, you know, so I think it's something to bear in mind.
But I'm not wrong to say, Alex, right, that under the JCPOA, there would not have been international inspections after 10 years. And that was 10 years ago, so that would be now. That would be right now.
But it's a bit of a moot point now, I mean, regardless, because, you know, we have a different president, we have a different policy, and so, you know.
Back to the letters, and we welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. from Vincent. Could it be that Iran has studied the North Korea model of deterrence, which is to say a defense deterrence model? If we have nuclear weapons, no one is going to attack us or mess with us, and not an offensive strategy, which would lead to annihilation?
I'm not sure I understand, because...
Is this based on the whole premise of mutually assured destruction? Is that, I'm wondering if that what this person is asking about.
The letter writer is suggesting that Iran wanted a nuclear weapon purely for deterrence? I mean, isn't it pretty to think so?
To say that North Korea, what they refer to, what the listener refers to as the North Korea model, which is deterrence. That you have a defense deterrence model so that if we have nuclear weapons, no one's going to attack us or mess around with
us. I suppose, but on the other hand, you're talking about a country that has been chanting death to America and death to Israel nonstop for 50 years. So that doesn't sound like they're interested in a defensive posture to me.
Amy writes, I would really like to hear some mention in your discussion this morning about the fact that Donald Trump has no authority to enter this conflict without approval from Congress.
Oh, yes. This is important.
And Congress people stand on this? That's from Amy.
Nothing like a good Article II conversation.
Right?
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know the answer to this. When was the last time a president went to Congress to get authority to use them for military action?
I was trying to think about it.
It is obviously the exception, not the rule now.
It feels like it.
Because
we have a lot, we're having a lot of Article II conversations right now, especially in the immigration context. Nevertheless, I feel like he would need to go to Congress, but something tells me that there's an act out there that they would try to utilize to move forward with this. Who knows?
Russ says Mr. Trump has said his decision on intervening in the Iran-Israel conflict might be altered by the course of the conflict because in a few days events could alter the conditions of the war. It is concerning that the foreign policy of the United States would depend on the ebb and flow of attacks and responses. But we are now living in an era in which all of the alliances made by the United States are conditional and open to interpretation. We no longer believe in anything. I assume that the intention there of we don't believe in anything strongly.
Well, I mean, back to what Alex was saying earlier, this is one of the things that got Trump into office, right, was the America first and no foreign entanglements, you know, neo-isolationism, if you like. You know, that's the thing that is riling some elements of his base. You know, those of us who are more kind of, you know, traditional conservatives view that as short-sighted. But, you know, that's the subject or that's the source of the tension that Alex was referring to at the top of the broadcast.
And it has powerful historical roots in American political culture.
I mean, for good and for ill.
For good and for ill. I mean, just sort of, you know, the whole significant hesitation of the United States to get involved in World War II, the American first, movement at that time.
Charles Lindbergh,
the German-American Bund. You know, and you know the friendliness of those movements, and in some cases the direct links to Nazi Germany, are something to bear in mind. I mean, it is interesting that this, you know, the whole idea of America, full autonomy and non-involvement in global affairs is always precipitated by the possibility of war. It's never this kind of, you know, freestanding discussion or like matter of principle. There's always a sense that it's kind of catalyzed by some international conflict.
Bill writes to us, and I'm going to preface this. This is a cranky letter. Bill writes to us and says, and there it is, the same hawkish attitude that got us into Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Thanks, Bob. I hope this letter gets read as I won't hear it. I turned off the station after you stated that this will be a quick strike and done. Some of us Americans never learn. And yes, I mean you.
I'll show myself to the door. No, look, what it's worth.
In an hour.
Okay. Mm. if I foresaw this as a protracted conflict, then I would have a very different viewpoint on this.
But that's the whole conversation, right? And that's the conversation that needs to happen. And that's the conversation that's not happening. And I feel like we're not hearing that from the Trump administration. Is that this idea that it's going to be quick, yeah. But we already have experienced similar issues, even though it's not the same as this nuclear issue. Yeah. We both know that you're not going to go in there, bomb it, and leave. Like, that's just not how it works, logistically, right? That's not how it works, especially in the Middle East. And we experienced this over and over again, I think. And so I think a lot of people are concerned, and rightfully so, about what happens in the aftermath.
Well, can I ask a question then, Sienna? I've not seen any polling on this. Maybe it doesn't exist. As a general rule, historically, and Alex, you know, tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, America has tended to, when our military action has resulted in regime change, if you like, we have, you know, we have tended, going back to the Marshall Plan, right, to feel we have an obligation to stay involved. Do we feel that way? Do the American people feel that way about Iran right now? I simply don't know the answer.
You go ahead.
My sense is, I cannot speak, you know, for what the American people might think about this. All I can say is that the Trump administration clearly does not think in these terms. It is not interested in any kind of, you know, a sense of responsibility, help with the reconstruction of those nations, you know, that have been affected by these conflicts. And this, by the way, is a significant trend in, you know, quite a bit of, you know, global relations right now having to do with the responsibility of the victors to the people who've lost, right? We're hearing this right now in various ways in terms of the genocide that's taking place in southern Sudan. There's not much, coverage of that at the moment, unfortunately. Is there a sense that the people who, you know, emerge as victorious in the from the conflict are interested in seeing the country become fully established and kind of viable, you know, as a modern state? No, not necessarily. Putin himself has openly said, you know, that he is not interested in any peace deal that would require subventions from the Russian Federation to rebuild parts of Ukraine that are not conquered by Russia. All right. The parts of Ukraine that would be annexed by Russia, sure. But those parts that have been destroyed, devastated, such as central Ukraine around Kyiv and western Ukraine, no, he says. You know, I'm willing to withdraw my forces, but, you know, I will not withdraw them as long as the West insists that I, you know, chip in to the rebuilding of the entire, whatever rump state of Ukraine is left after he's taken away one-fifth of it, you know. And Trump himself has said that, you know, victory goes to the spoils. You know, he said this in regard to Iraq. He says that oil is ours.
We're late for a break, so let's hold there. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more time to discuss this and other matters. We will do exactly that. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. First News with Ray Graff. Oh, it's hard to fade out of that one. Okay. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our second hour of our panel discussion. We welcome you. We have a great group with us this morning, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert. Alexander Mihailovich is with us, a professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, and Robert Prendicio, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and we thank you all for being here. Okay, so let's change topics and talk baseball. Talk baseball, public radio style, in the form of an ice raid.
You mean you don't want to talk about the Mets' 5-game losing streak?
No, actually, well, that's all I want to talk about, actually. But the story is interesting, and I'm very interested in
everyone's perspective, but certainly Sienna's. I find the story to be fascinating. So the L.A. Dodgers yesterday blocked federal immigration agents from accessing Dodger Stadium parking lots on Thursday, according to the team. Immigration and Customs Enforcement denied having agents at the stadium, while the Department of Homeland Security acknowledged that Customs and Border Protection vehicles were present. I think at one point they said they were just turning around. This morning, ICE agents came to Dodger Stadium and requested permission to access the parking lots, the Dodgers wrote on social media Thursday afternoon. They were denied entry to the grounds by the organizations, and the game scheduled was played as scheduled. In a social media post, the Department of Homeland Security said the incident had nothing to do with the Dodgers. Customs and Border Protection vehicles were in the stadium parking lot very briefly, unrelated to any operation or enforcement, according to the DHS. ICE called the statement from the Dodgers false, writing in a post on X, "We were never there." Local media reported that protesters arrived at the stadium after accounts of immigration agents near the parking lot had circulated on social media. Armed agents with covered faces stood near unmarked SUVs outside the stadium lot. The Los Angeles Times reported that local police eventually arrived and the agents drove off. In an emailed statement, the LAPD said its role was limited to facilitating the safe departure of the vehicles from that area. This is another example of the federal administration doing everything in their power to strike fear and hurt hardworking families, said Diana Crofts-Paleo, Director of Communications for California Governor Gavin Newsom.
So this is an excellent example of when the Fourth Amendment meets baseball. Right? Yeah. That's exactly what happened here.
Is there another example?
Oh, you know, I'm sure there'll be many. But I think, you know, I was kind of heartened to see this because what you saw was an organization, an employer saying that you have no right to be on our private property. Now, asterisk, there is a question whether or not a public parking lot has a reasonable expectation of privacy there. That's a Fourth Amendment legal discussion that can be had. But that was the LA Dodgers saying you don't have the right to come onto our property unless you have a warrant signed by a federal judge. And that is what you saw. And that is what we've been advising a lot of people is to exercise that Fourth Amendment right when it comes to ICE. And that's why what you're seeing in practice on a day-to-day is you're seeing them picking up people who are walking on the streets, going into buildings, or in federal buildings like immigration court. So this is exactly what happened. This is them putting their foot down and saying, unless you have a warrant or the right to be on our property, we're not going to allow you to come onto our property and ask questions of the individuals there.
And that was, I don't know exactly how to put this, but let's assume that the worst case scenario that was that they were there for an operation of how that would have played out within the parking lot of the Dodgers game that night.
Exactly. If you know, so I think a lot of people aren't aware, but I like to make people aware, is that most law enforcement agencies around the country, I should say, participate in secure communities. Secure communities is when there is anyone, a criminal arrested or what have you, it goes into the federal system. At that point, ICE is notified that someone, a foreign national, might have broken the law. At that point, they can go and obtain that person from the law enforcement or what have you, right? So to answer your question, if there was an operation, if there was someone there who had broken the law or they had any sort of risk, national security risk, they could have went to a judge and a judge would have to sign out on their ability to come into that private property. And that's how Fourth Amendment works. And they did not have that, which tells us that they were just looking for people. And so that's what happened.
Yeah, I just wanted to pull the camera lens back a little bit. This is, from what happened in Los Angeles itself, you know, at Dodger Stadium. To consider Trump's general recent statements and kind of flip-flopping on certain policies in regard to immigration. 2 weeks ago, some of the representatives of the hospitality industry and of American farmers said, look, with your immigration policies, you're actually hurting us because we need some of those workers. So what Trump did was issue a kind of a makeshift ad hoc exemption for some of the red states who were parts of those industry, agriculture and the hospitality industry. What he's doing now is kind of shifting the camera lens back onto the cities in the blue states. And so this is in some ways a kind of, you know, I think that there's a kind of performative aspect to it. You know, he wants to still, he doesn't want to seem soft on immigration. So he has to display some kind of, you know, critical, decisive action somewhere. And he can't do it in some of those industries, you know, where people were saying, you're actually hurting us. And some of those people are his base.
Well, you know, we're seeing even more. It's even more complicated than that, because since that time, 2 weeks ago, just yesterday, we've heard that he's rolling back that policy.
Because
because what you have in the administration is you have the Stephen Miller advisor saying that he wants at least 3,000 people arrested.
Right.
He wants to see more people being picked up.
Right.
And that's why we have this insurgency of people being detained on their way to immigration court,
right.
People being detained on their way to the USCIS office to get an immigration benefit. Mm. We see those people being detained is because you have this quota.
Right.
And so now you're seeing that get rolled back, even that
right.
policy that I wouldn't call it policy. It was kind right. of, like you said, some pseudo statement.
Right.
Even that's being rolled back. And it's also, even that statement was hard to even enforce realistically.
Yeah, of course.
Because these farm workers, these hotel workers go home.
Right.
Right? And then when they go home and they're on the way to work, that's when ICE usually gets them, and when they're on public areas. Mm. And so who's to say, you know, do they bring them in and once they find out where they work, they let them out now?
Mm.
You know, that's not happening on the ground right now. That's not what we're seeing.
So the quota is something that is artificial. It is this kind of, a provocative meme. Much of it is coming from Stephen Miller. We said we need to, arrest at least 3,000 people per day. Tom Homan, who is in charge of all of this nominally, he said, well, right now, unfortunately, we're only arresting about 2,000 people. So, I wonder if this is some kind of, flexing of muscles to some extent.
And let's just, I'm sorry, one more thing. And let's just,
yeah.
I wrote the numbers down. Right now, ICE is detained to fund about 41,500 individuals. Mm-hmm. And right now, they have about 51,000 people being detained. Just logistically, it's being very difficult for them to achieve this.
Of course.
And we're starting to see that in practice now. Because we are able to see individuals who are being picked up, but then they're being let go on ankle monitors. And I know that's not the intent, right? Ankle monitors, other forms of supervision, but there's nowhere for them to go.
Right.
I mean, the resources that it takes to detain these individuals and their families is massive. And I think that's something the American people must understand, that this must be funded.
Right.
Because it's so expensive to have them here detained and then fly them to their home country. We're talking about flights. And so it's a very expensive undertaking as well.
Yeah. And I think one other thing we need to bear in mind about what specifically happened here is that the Dodgers organization announced that it was interested in supporting immigrant communities. And so this is the raid or pseudo raid or the driving around the parking lot, to find a way out, to go the opposite direction of a road. All of that is kind of, pushback against, the Dodgers organization openly coming out and making this statement. Now, I'm not sure exactly what they had concretely in mind in terms of supporting immigrant organizations. That's a whole other question. But I think that, there is a sense that any time a major organization, within the sporting world or the entertainment industry makes a statement like this, the Trump administration somehow feels beholden or obliged to, push back in a vigorous way.
Yeah.
I said earlier I'm hawkish on Iran. I'm fairly dovish on immigration. That said, whenever this topic comes up on the roundtable, I always feel compelled to say, you know, this is an 80-20 issue, right? Like, you know, the politics of this. This is what got Donald Trump elected. This is a core issue. So yes, you're right, Sienna, about the and you're wise to bring up the cost and the implementation. But politically, this is a winning issue for this administration.
You know what's so interesting though? In practice, when you whether it's red state or blue state, and when you hear people talking and people come to me, I think they completely agree that this was a big issue. But they're always I always get the statement, but I didn't think it was going to be this guy.
Right.
And I didn't think it was going to be this guy. That's all. And I'm always like, who did you think it would be? The criminals. And I'm like, I see what you're saying. But that I think what we're starting to see a little bit of, and I think that's what's concerning, is you're seeing that pushback when you saw the farms and the hotel workers from those owners saying, wait, what about my guys?
Of course.
Right?
Of course.
What about my guys? And so what happens when that pushback happens? And that's what I'm seeing right now in practice. I'm seeing a lot of people getting frustrated because they don't have the workers, so to speak. The workers, I'm putting up quotes.
Yeah.
And so now we're seeing a little pushback on this and saying, I thought you said only criminals.
Yeah. Right. You know, that said, Alex, you brought up, you know, the Dodgers statement, and forgive me for diverting into sports as opposed to just immigration. But my goodness, will sports teams and leagues never learn the lesson that Michael Jordan tried to teach us 30, 40 years ago that, you know, Republicans buy shoes too? It always kind of just disheartens me that they feel the need to take public stands. It's never a winning issue for sports teams to do this.
I mean, I think that there's also there's something else going on here, which is that there's baseball very specifically has, you know, a kind of profile in the American consciousness, especially in some of the major cities, where it's tied fundamentally to the neighborhoods or the parts of the cities where the stadiums, you know, the ballparks are located.
Sure.
You know, growing up in Chicago, you know, with the two losing teams, you know, the National and American League team, you know, there was a sense like the White Sox represented the South Chicago, and the people who supported them were African Americans and white ethnics, you know. You know, the children of immigrants like myself. The North Side was a little bit more affluent. It was kind of, you know, a downtown crowd, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that, you know, many American urban communities are going to be very sensitive about, like, you know, threats to, you know, their home teams as a kind of a mirror of who they are, you know, is an aggregate of communities or neighborhoods. So I'm sympathetic to this pushback. I have to admit.
And to your point, to amplify your point, I think 30% of the players in the major leagues are international players, maybe more.
Yeah.
But look, that said, and I'm being parochial here. I'm hard pressed to think of a single example in my lifetime of a sports team or league taking a strong political stance that did not backfire.
Hmm.
It's almost always a political loser for them.
I'm putting on my ESPN hat, and it's very small, and it does not fit my head because I'm not watching ESPN, and I'm like trying to think of a good example.
Yeah, and look, I mean, I don't know this, but I also
I'm sure my husband's texting me now.
We're probably because this makes me uncomfortable as well when activist groups try to compel any group to make a statement. You know I think there's been some of that, as I understand, in Los Angeles with the protesters demanding that the Dodgers make statements and whatnot, and other organizations and.
You know,
that always rubs me the wrong way.
You're seeing it in a lot of communities, especially when you're dealing with immigration, because I think a lot of people feel like their group is being targeted specifically.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think when you patronize a place, you want to feel like that place supports you, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think I think you must say that no one's asking for any organization or entity to say that you should harbor foreign nationals who broke the law or who are criminals. No one's saying that. But someone's saying that you should recognize that we've been a part of your audience or your clientele, and we want to feel like you support us. And I think asking an entity to come out and say we support immigrants who supported us is not a big ask to me, in terms of that. You're not asking them to support illegal actions. You're not asking them to support. You're saying support the community. And immigrants in a community does not necessarily mean that someone does not have lawful status. So support of immigrants does not mean that you're supporting anyone who did something contrary to the law.
No, I don't disagree with that at all. I'm making a broader point, which is I don't care for coerced statements from the right or the left.
Yeah, I get it. But how do you make it? I don't know. But how do you make it stand? How do you keep this from happening again at other ballparks? How do you keep this happening again Dodger Stadium?
Are we sure that anything happened? I mean, this to me is clear as mud. The Dodgers say that they were, or at least implying in their statement that there was going to be a raid. Homeland Security says no. Maybe it did sound cartoonish to say we were just in the parking lot, for staging. I'm not clear on what was going down in Dodger Stadium yesterday. Is anybody?
They were denied access to the grounds.
Okay.
By the Dodgers organizations.
It's not far-fetched to assume that they were going to be on the grounds as people got out to, what do you guys call it, tailgate. They would be asking them questions and things like that. I don't know what you guys do in those parking lots. I've never participated. You know better than me.
Here's what we do, Sienna. We pay like $75 to park.
Yeah, exactly. You pay that much, you better do something.
And then you walk about 4 miles, and then you spend like $27 at Dodger Stadium on a show for dogs. That's what we do.
And then you leave after the 6 miles.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because
I don't know what goes on there.
See a Tawny, you say, all right, there you go, and then you leave. But I mean, it's a good point. Because I was wondering, it's just like, then, and maybe I'm just making this up. I don't know. But I ask, this is a serious question. If you're the Dodgers organization and ICE shows up at the door, the assumption may be, okay, we're going after the fans of the game. But what about the game itself? What about the players? What about the coaches? What about the people who work within the Dodgers organization who were on the grounds at that time?
All very fair questions. And listen, the reason why I said that it's not far-fetched is because that's what's actually happening, right? We're actually seeing that what ICE tends to do is they tend to hang around parking lots and approach people who they believe may be here in this country without proper documentation. That's just what's happening out in the country right now. And I think that's exactly what was going to happen. And I think that's what the Dodgers concern. It's like what we're seeing at schools right now. You've seen a report come out. I don't have the numbers. But you've seen enrollment attendance reduce because people are afraid of walking their kids to school. So this is actually something that's happening in the country right now. And it's very feasible for the Dodgers to be concerned about, you know, their fans not showing up to do the tailgate or the game.
Well, especially considering the well documented random nature of some of the ICE arrests. I mean,
exactly.
They sometimes just accost people who they see walking, who they assume are have some kind of problematic immigrant status. Because
as I stated earlier, if they had appointed removal order that they were executing and they were concerned about the safety and well-being of someone at that Dodger Stadium, they would have went to see a federal judge, got something signed off, presented to the Dodger stadium and said, we need to be here on this property at this time for the security because there's someone here that we're concerned about.
And we do have a letter, which I'm looking into to see, because I don't know the truth of it. The listener is saying that the Dodgers had let ICE on the property before there was huge pushback and threats of boycott. So the Dodgers responded by telling ICE to leave this time. Don't make them heroes. It's bottom line stuff.
Haven't heard that.
I have not heard that either.
I have not heard that either.
People
are entitled to change their minds, under the circumstances. Maybe they decided that, that initially tolerant policy vis-a-vis Weiss was no longer feasible,
My happiest part of today is Sienna asking what goes on those. And I don't have a good answer.
Well, tailgating is not a thing for baseball.
Not so much for baseball.
I told you my ESPN hat is small. I don't know what you guys do.
Well, but, I don't know, but yeah.
But Alex raises a good point. If I'm paying $75 for parking, I sure as heck want to do something more than just walk into the stadium. There better be something there.
Hmm. Yeah, other
so
than
let's,
getting
let's,
deported.
We'll start a movement.
Yeah, sure.
Ouch.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll wrap up the show for this Friday morning. My thanks to our great group here. They'll continue to show off, and we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. We were just sorry for the delay. We were talking about tailgating with Sienna. Okay.
And they showed me pictures.
Yes. I have the lamest picture of tailgating.
And I'm going to take Sienna to a Buffalo Bills game.
Well, he does not paint his face, allegedly.
But I will if you go.
I'm loving this so much. All right. Let's see. Let's go to... Let's see. I'm just checking the time here. We've got some getting a few articles here, I believe. One is the I want to talk about the record debt limit and the debt limit precedent, as the New York Times refers to it. A proposed $5 trillion debt limit increase could make it hard for Republicans to maintain their fiscal hawk credibility, says the second line of the headline of this article. For years, Republicans have warned about the government's reliance on borrowed money to pay its bills. That stance has often led to standoffs over raising the nation's borrowing cap, with Republicans insisting that any increase in America's so-called debt limit be paired with spending reductions. This year, the party of fiscal conservatism is poised to discard that philosophy as Republicans prepare to press ahead with domestic policy legislation that combines nearly $4 trillion in tax cuts with a $5 trillion increase to the debt limit. An increase of that magnitude would be a record and underscore the ideological flexibility that many Republicans are willing to embrace when they are in power. GOP lawmakers are prepared to push through the debt limit increase with only votes from their party through a budget process called reconciliation that is making it harder for Republicans to maintain their fiscal hawk credibility, prompting some resistance from a few lawmakers who have warned that they may not vote for the bill if it includes such a large increase in the borrowing cap. Robert.
What fiscal hawk reputation are we talking about? The Republicans? Since when? Come on. I mean, this is not the point I think you wanted to discuss, Joe, but when I read this piece in the New York Times, my immediate response was disappointment in the New York Times, although I shouldn't be, for just carrying the Democrats' water. I don't detect a great deal of fiscal hawkishness on the part of the Republicans. I haven't for quite some time, but why are we letting the Democrats off the hook for not wanting to rein in entitlement spending? In other words, this entire debate just feels to me like mendacity on both sides and has from day one.
On the other hand, in the article, they do point out that there's that both Elizabeth Warren and Trump are agree essentially that there should be a suspension of the debt limit, which is sort of even thinking
that troubles me.
Yeah, even thinking of a kind of a notional alliance or sort of convergence between those two very different people is something that's kind of mind bending. So I think that they're trying to get at some nuance here.
You're detecting nuance with Elizabeth Warren and Donald Trump.
Well, no, I'm
Mazel
all,
tov, as my all people
I,
not
I wouldn't
say.
Not nuance. How can I put it? I mean, there's at least an attempt in the article, however imperfect, to
call it cover.
Yeah, that's a good word.
Right? Okay, all right. Yeah,
back to the cynical journalist part. But yeah, I mean, isn't that what it is? I mean, they're saying okay, it's okay if you do it, but not if we do it. If you do it, it's bad. If we do it, it's okay.
Right.
And you can they and we can put into whatever frame we want to.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is, you know, Robert, I just want to, you know, bring out this whole idea of, you know, that you've pointed out, you know, the fiscal conservatism, you know, of the Republican Party is a bit of, are you saying this kind of a myth? I just
wanted, of course.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Good. I just wanted to, you know, clarify.
Neither party has demonstrated any kind of serious. I've said this on the roundtable before, but, you know, I love that old John D. Rockefeller quote about, you know, the older I get, the less attention I pay to what men say. I merely watch what they do.
Right.
I defy you to look at either party for the last 30 years and detect a hint of fiscal conservatism.
I mean, some people might say that what Doge was attempting to achieve was
sure.
some version of, you know, of slimming down the state.
Fair.
You know, so there's that, I suppose. And indeed, some of the Republicans, you know, have been pointing to that as saying, like, well, we need to make up a little bit for, you know, we have some wiggle room because we've slimmed down this, you know, the government in other ways as a result of, you know, Elon Musk and, you know, Trump's general fiscal policy. And in this regard, we can be a little bit more open to the idea of either suspending the debt limit or raising it, you know. But
my point, Alex, is any conversation about the budget that is not about reining in entitlement spending is just deeply unserious.
Mm. I'm dovish on this issue.
Okay. I'm dovish on this issue. That is
which
okay.
Which one? I'm taxing or spending?
On the whole article. The whole article. I'm just poking around right here.
No, I know.
when I read the article, I just said this is here we go, another conversation that, you know, it's very circular. And we've been down this road before, and they want us, we were all asking questions when we were watching what Doge was doing and watching them cut back. I thought initially the idea was that Doge were going to have all these cutbacks, they're going to get out fraud and waste, then we're going to have the tariffs that was going to bring in this money, right? That was the idea, and none of that is happening. And so we're just watching this spending bill go through, and what was supposed to happen to make up for the spending bill didn't happen, and there you go. That's just it.
I mean, it's in many ways a logical extension. I mean, the fact that the Republicans are now, you know, plunking down more openly and saying, like, you know, we don't want to suspend the debt limit. We don't want, you know, we would like to suspend it or raise it. The money has to come from somewhere.
Right.
And as Sienna, you point out, it's not coming
from the tariffs.
You know?
That was the idea.
You know, and so there's this kind of almost grim necessary calculus that, you know, has to take place.
Yeah. I started earlier today or earlier the broadcast saying that, you know, I viewed Iran as an existential threat. Well, I view this as an existential threat. I do not want my children and future grandchildren growing up in a country that's in fiscal collapse.
Exactly. And aren't we nearing the end of the 90-day deal period for the tariffs? Is that almost over? Where he was supposed to do all these deals in 90 days?
Yeah, you're right.
That's also unserious.
Yes. Exactly.
I mean, that's back to the two-week thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty much the same.
Like, so it's just, you know, disappointing, I would say, on all fronts.
All right. Final item up for bids in our showcase showdown on this Friday afternoon, Friday morning, as we go into Friday afternoon. Yesterday was Juneteenth. We mentioned that at the beginning of the program. Juneteenth went uncelebrated at the White House as Trump complains about too many holidays. And so I think this brings up an interesting point. I want to get the one line here because I thought there was the fact that this was not the Juneteenth was not celebrated in the way that it should be celebrated as it's been celebrated for the last as it was enshrined into law 4 years ago. But obviously, 4 years ago, for the last 4 years, has been the Biden administration. Now it's the Trump administration. So Juneteenth, the holiday that marks the end of slavery in the United States, has been celebrated at the White House each June 19th since it was enshrined into law 4 years ago. But on Thursday, it went unmarked by the president, except for a post on social media in which he said he would get rid of some non-working holidays. Soon we'll end up having a holiday for every once working day of the year,
Mr. Trump said in mangled syntax, not mentioning Juneteenth by name nor acknowledging that Thursday was a federal holiday. It must change if we're going to make America great again. And Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, indicated to reporters earlier in the day that she was not aware of any plans by Mr. Trump to sign a holiday proclamation. In the past week alone, he'd issued proclamations commemorating Father's Day, Flag Day, National Flag Week, and the 250th anniversary of the Battle of Bunker Hill, none of them which are among the 11 annual federal holidays.
Boy. You know, if you wake up in the morning determined to find something that Donald Trump does to be angry about, you will always find something. And that said, he doesn't have to make it quite so easy, right? You know, this should have been a layup. It's just dumb politics. To your point, Joe, you know, you issue proclamations for, you know, everything under the sun. So, you know, there's no cost to having you know, it's not like this guy's, you know, not tweeting a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it wouldn't have been that hard to put something up. Just an unforced error. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think, you know, I completely agree. I just think it was just another kind of push that he's made right now to kind of dismantle some of the pillars of African-American Black history. And we take it on the chin and we keep walking. And that's unfortunately what we have to deal with this administration.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I think it's I just wanted to raise, you know, the point that this is also something that is, this is a position that is not uncharacteristic of the harder wing of the Republican Party. I just wanted to remind people about Pat Buchanan's opposition in the mid-80s to a Martin Luther King Jr. Day. He expressed this in terms that were very similar to Trump's, you know, too many holidays, you know, people need to work more days a week, more days, you know, more days a year. And this is taking away. And of course, Martin Luther King Jr., there's many aspects of his legacy, according to Pat Buchanan, that were problematic and divisive and unsympathetic to some of the positions and people living in the Deep South, you know. So I see this as in some ways, you know, a kind of a cyclical expression of a certain kind of hardcore nativist politics. And let's not forget that, you know, broadly speaking, Buchanan, for example, represented that with his presidential campaign in the 90s, his isolationism, his sympathy towards the Russian Federation in many ways after the fall of communism. So anyway. You know.
And also it was a signal to a certain sect of his base, right? It made a certain sect of his base very happy for him to say it, very happy not to issue a proclamation. And, you know, no one's surprised by his actions. And I was just thinking last night about this, and I was like, technically he doesn't have to run again. Technically he doesn't need, quote unquote, the black vote. I wonder how much of that kind of goes into his formulaic thinking, because we did have one from him in prior administrations. I think there was one.
That's right. In his last administration, before it was a federal holiday, last time he was in office, he issued a statement saying, Melania and I send our warmest greetings to all those celebrating Juneteenth, a historic day recognizing the end of slavery. So that was 3 years. 4 years ago, I guess, 5 years ago. So that is interesting. That's one interesting thing. The other, I didn't know we had a flag week. I knew we had flag day. I didn't know we had flag week. I didn't know we had a whole week for the flag.
Well,
I mean, we should. I'm not saying we shouldn't. It's just I didn't know that.
I don't like playing guess what's in Donald Trump's head.
Agreed.
You know, so I, you know. It's just not
well. There goes the bonus round.
it's not that interesting to me.
How are we going to go for fast money, Bob?
I mean, let's
but
not.
For what it's worth, as the token center right person on the round table, it's a great conservative holiday, right? In other words, if you're Donald Trump, you should be celebrating Juneteenth. You want to show that this is this is what's good about America. Yes, we are the country that was founded in slavery. We're the country that ended it as well. This is something that conservatives should celebrate.
But you know, I just want to also point out
20
that,
seconds. But
yeah,
go ahead.
20 seconds. That this is not just about Donald Trump. It's also his whole administration. Pete Hegseth has come out against the holiday as well.
Oh, well, Pete said
yeah,
it.
So,
disappointing us all. Yeah. Thank you all. You're great. We'll be back right after this.